You are listening to Cliff Saron on ComputerWeekly.com podcasts, where you can listen to and download interviews with leading experts on key topics of IT management and technology. Today I am joined by Andy Mulholland, who is the Global Chief Technology Officer of Capgemini. In the first part of this podcast, Andy spoke to me about why SOA is important to the business. In this interview, we'll find out why SOA is a good fit with innovations such as mashups and Web 2.0. So Andy, what is the relationship between SOA and Web 2?
Well, first of all, Web 2 in most people's minds will seem to be yet another acronym, just as REST, and it seems to be overcomplicating things. So if you're struggling with SOA, why would you want the additional complication? Actually, it's not that bad. Back in September 2005, Tim O'Reilly, who's a very famous man in the industry, actually ran an event, and they came out with seven very clear principles that controlled what is a Web 2 application, or what is a Web 2 service, or however you like to think of that word. So it's not a randomized concept. It actually has very specific values, and REST, as a way of dealing with that architecturally, is equally well-defined. The $64,000 question is, where's the benefit? What kind of process would you design for a business that would tie these together and make the idea that people and interactions in people and the use of data and content would improve a business process? So I'm going to give you an example of an EU agricultural subsidies officer. And if you look at their job, which is evaluating various crops being grown, various livestock or whatever, the whole first part of that task is very subjective. It may be maps to determine field boundaries, it may be photographs to determine what's being grown, it may be all kinds of sources of data, much of which doesn't belong to their own organization. There is a small process and some data in there. The process is, once I've decided what to pay you, we need to pay you, and we should have a record of what we paid you last year and the year before. But a large amount of the job is subjective. If you think of that subjectivity and think of a group of, say, 20 subsidy officers working together, as they look at information and look at photographs or anything else, their ability to tag that information in the way they would contextually see it. This is a photograph of Church Farm. It contains apple orchards. It contains, rape or oilseed or whatever it is they look for. A computer and a filing system in a computer can't do that. Knowledge management is okay, but it's still quite difficult to close the gap between the people and the knowledge management, and the knowledge management has a fixed taxonomy anyway. So the idea that they would find it easier to use a folksonomy, the way they see it as people, in that situation to pool and share information and work around that subjective use is clearly attractive. And it's somewhere we haven't been before with computer systems. Then at the end of that, you need to make sure that the information they used is at least recognizable and consistent if there was a challenge about how did they arrive at that.
It seems to me that the service-oriented architecture is a bit like snake oil. It can do all things to all men. Do you see any situation where the SOA is not suitable?
Yes, I do, and I also accept your point. The industry is always in love with the latest thing and believes that everyone else should be in love with it and should buy it. That's both a strength and a weakness. The simple fact of the matter is that where you have existing systems, we call them legacy, but I think that's almost being rude to them, existing systems that are doing a really good job, where the process and the procedures work really well, then stability for compliance purposes and manageability of those is actually key. Under those conditions, you are more likely to want to continue to keep the system as it is. You're more likely to want to continue to use existing methods to manage integration around the data and the state of that data, come to that. And it seems unlikely that it's going to be a big help. It would be easy to then say, well, don't think of it in legacy, but that's probably not quite true. If you go back to the book-to-bill sequences and the strong move towards, I want to be able to do that externally, you will need an SOA layer to reface those, so you expose those legacy systems to this new world in a way that they can work. So the resurfacing of those systems to link with that would be a good use. But no, I mean, if you look at it in a very simple way and say, if you were running the subsidy system I've just talked about, you will have a series of machines and a series of applications that are making the subsidy payments. Your reason to rip that apart is very low. You would probably want to carry on with much of what you do now. What I explained about the subsidy offices in front of that is literally that. It's in front of the existing system. So if my task is to manage and run and continue to look after the existing systems and their data centricity and the compliance of those systems and the security of them, it's unlikely I'm going to find immediately the SOA is offering me a benefit case.
One of the things that you mentioned to me earlier was that you have recently written a book, Mashup Corporations, which features a company that has some challenges and is using the service-oriented architecture as a way to overcome those. Would you like to tell me a little bit about that?
The book was written for a very simple reason, and the reason was that I was challenged by a friend, Paul Kachina, who's the head of the Global SAP Users Association, to make some more sense of the whole argument of SOA and what it meant and what it delivered. Fortunately, he delivered the challenge to me when I was with a good friend, Chris Thomas, who's the CTO of Intel, and we decided that we needed to find a better way to explain it. What concerned us was that on one hand we had a lot of books around technology, and on the other hand we had business people who, quite frankly, unless they can see a reason for technology, will not spend money on it. And there didn't seem to be anything that was in the middle that linked the two worlds together. And what we set out to write in the book was a way of helping both sides understand what the other one could see in it and would get from it. And the form we used, because we were writing slightly over a year ago now, was the idea of a fictitious company and the people in it and how they found a new way of running their business in and a new revenue stream, and how they then had to work together to change their approach to using technology to deliver it. The story is very simple and it involves a mashup, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But essentially it's a fictitious company called Vorpal. Vorpal is a supplier of food preparation equipment. One of their products is a popcorn popper, slightly American, I'm afraid, the book. And they sell it in a very usual way. It goes to distribution and it goes onto shelves in stores. And they hope someone walking by makes a connection with the product and a need and buys it. Now, actually, it's not that simple. They usually have to promote things like that. There are seasons when they promote them and so on. What happens in the book is that a younger member of the marketing department finds that by placing a popcorn popper into other websites at crucial moments, you can increase sales. What he actually realizes is that if you were organizing a social evening to watch your team in the finals of the World Cup or something like that, then if you could, in the middle of the website by which you're finding out the times and everything else, you could find a popcorn popper in your team's colours, you would probably buy it to aid the sociality or the experience.
So why mashups?
The easiest way I have to explain a mashup is to say that we understand spreadsheets and we understand the idea of having a master spreadsheet and a set of sub-spreadsheets. Make a change in a sub-spreadsheet, it will change in your master. There are obvious limits to the scalability of that. There are obvious limits to the proprietary nature of the product you use to do it. And probably slightly worse, it's quite difficult to interpret some of the figures unless you are a CFO and you love figures. What we are doing with mashups is taking information that is represented and presented as web pages, and we're drawing it together to create our own web page, effectively showing that information. A very popular way to do that is to take something like Google Earth, and indeed the generally accepted example is to say, think of buying a house, take a Google Earth map of the area you're interested in, take pricing from estate agents, overlay it on top of that so you can see the different areas and the pricing, overlay maybe crime statistics, public transport, whatever. And you very clearly have a visual picture of the neighbourhood to understand where it seemed right for you to go. Now, that is a mashup. It comes from the term of DJs putting music tracks together, but essentially it's a way of representing many different forms of information, not only from your own company but from elsewhere, into something that gives you the view and perspective you want. So in the book, the mashup is how your content around the provision of the popcorn popper is mashed into the content of fan sites and other things to be able to be seen as part of a good experience.
Andy, what is the benefit of developing a mashup, given that once you have produced the code, it has to be maintained, and you will have customers and they'll require some kind of a service level?
Yeah, that's a good point, because the personal use of mashups has certainly grown very rapidly. And there are sites, by the way, mashup.com, mashable.com, that give you lists of APIs to be able to create your own. If you look at it commercially, there's quite a number of companies around who are now doing this. One of the sectors that, or there are a couple of sectors that have been very active. One is financial services, where dealers clearly like mashups more than spreadsheets to pull information together today. But a very good example is actually in the utilities market. In the utilities market, geospatial applications are very expensive, and they're very difficult to maintain as well. Using Google Earth as a base on which to lay things gives you a much quicker way of being able to build and see relevance. The particular story I like, actually, was around the looking at where the power grid should lay. And the power company in question could not understand why they had some of the lower cost housing areas were the massive users of power. It just did not make sense to any statistic they had. Remember, their statistics are they build a household, etc. The day they found the answer was the day they started to lay over the top of it information from sensors, from the census, and from that what people's occupations were and other things. And what they discovered was that many of those areas were co-located to universities and they were student houses. And in the student house, you effectively had, if there were four students, four household loads of gear. They each had a hi-fi, they each had a PC, they each had a television, etc. That's the kind of thing you see by being able to take sources of information that you would not normally be able to access and very quickly just paint them over the top of each other. So are we talking about heavy-duty transaction again? No. We're talking about lightweight interaction and the speed of being able to do this in a few hours to be able to satisfy a particular requirement. So we're back to this interaction again. But then think, if you had that information and you were designing power lines, there has to be some way of capturing what you found as substantive data, back to REST, and then there has to be some way of transacting that into, now how does the company use that information to actually gain an execution, and that takes you back to SOA.
Thank you very much, Andy. I'd like to ask, just as a sort of final question really, what your advice would be to businesses that really want to now start getting into SOA. There seems to be so many routes to produce something.
Yes, who benefits from SOA? Well, any architect, any enterprise architect is almost invariably studying the subject. If you go and talk to them, their frustration, however, is the extent to which they're allowed to use it. And when you pin that down, that relates to the extent to which business people are thinking about the way a process could work in order to use it. So my big tip on using SOA is not the technical problem. The question is, where in the organization, and that generally means one of two things. Are we looking to trade our ecosystem better? In which case you have this external dimension about how do I tie my existing systems to an externalized process? Or where in the company are we looking to improve our use of business intelligence? Because the argument there is, it's not only business intelligence around my information I need, it's actually around decision support about the market, my information, etc. And then how do I get an executable process behind it? In those areas, a relook at, together with the business, about the capability possibilities of designing and redesigning a process would be where it would really pay off.
Thank you, Andy, and thank you for listening. If you would like to hear why Andy believes SOA is a truly beneficial technique for organizations of all sizes, join us again on www.computerweekly.com/podcasts.